it please the court, counsel, good morning. On behalf of Mr. Arledge, my argument is going to divide it up into three parts. The first part would deal with the sufficiency of the evidence as it related to the conspiracy in count one, then address the sentencing issues, and then finally the counsel of choice issue that was raised as well. As far as the sufficiency of evidence as it relates to the money laundering count, I'd like to argue through and rely on the Dobbs case that I cited in my brief. And it basically states that the purpose of the money laundering statute is to reach commercial transactions intended, at least in part, to disguise the relationship of the item purchased with the person providing the proceeds, and that the proceeds used to make the purchase were obtained from illegal activities. And as you filter the evidence that was presented in the case through that construct of what the money laundering statute is intended to criminalize, the evidence clearly was insufficient to support that there was an agreement to violate the law. The first part to look at is, was there any concealment? I think because the lack of concealment in these transactions clearly is why we're here today, because everybody was identifiable. If you look at the cars that were purchased and the evidence that was presented,
yeah, you say that they were all identifiable, which at least in most cases may have well been true, but there were acts of concealment, such as calling purchases leases and falsifying the employment of the particular individuals who were purchases, and also failing to report over $10,000 to the IRS. All that was concealing the source of these funds.
I know the government's argument as it relates that these were leases versus purchases is some act of concealment. We respectfully disagree with that, because actually the leases in and of themselves didn't try to conceal anything. They clearly showed who the lessee was.
They did indeed try to conceal from any kind of arresting officer whether they owned the car or not, so that it would not be forfeited.
I think that's an argument that the government made, but the issue about forfeiture, I think the fact they were leases, as far as the way Mr. Arledge structured the transaction, was it was good business for him, because these were leases that they were paying, and that for them to maintain his equity in the car that he was also using to finance his dealership, that having them as leases...
As I understood it, both of them understood that the lease was not a lease, but it was a sale.
They were leases, and all the paperwork and all the exhibits that were introduced were entitled leases. They said they were leases. They were making monthly payments.
Were they leases? Did he purchase the car, or did he lease the car?
They were leases. They were not purchases.
Where does the government get the argument that they were purchases and not leases?
They're relying on the testimony of the cooperators who said, oh, I thought I was purchasing the car, but I think the evidence clearly shows how they couldn't actually believe that, because every document that they signed says this is a lease, these are the payments, this is the down payment, everything was entitled and structured as a lease, and so all the documentation clearly shows they were leases.
So they would have a down payment on a lease of $25,000 when the lease for the public would not require that much down payment?
Well, because the people that were leasing these cars, and I think Mr. Arledge testified this at trial, was these were people with poor credit. He was his own financing arm of the dealership when it came to these leases, and so he made sure that they had significant down payments and interest in the car to protect him if they defaulted later on. So it was a business model that he created that he, over time, realized this was effective when dealing with people who have necessarily not the best credit. And so that's how he created these leases and why he wanted money down. But there was nothing about that that then says, I'm trying to launder money for these people or not let the IRS know about these payments. He filed those 8300s, albeit late, but he did file those 8300s. But also, I think the other point is, when you look at the reporting of the money, that there wasn't any effort to conceal that from the IRS or the government, because when he deposited those at the bank, he didn't structure those transactions in any way. It did trigger the bulk cash reporting requirement from the bank, and there was no evidence that there was any structuring to avoid that. So there was nothing that Mr. Arledge did to then disguise the quantity that was being, down payment that was being made. And then also, I think the important part, too, is then you had this IRS undercover operation where he clearly stated, I'm going to have to file this form. So when you look at his intent and look at all the actions that he did, he was a car dealer trying to sell cars, but he didn't do anything with the intent to violate the law. I think that was clear from the lease paperwork that he had, that everybody was identifiable. There was nothing concealing about that. And I think also when you look at the intent of the money laundering statute, it's not to be just a mere spending, criminalized mere spending, and that's really what was going on here. There was nothing about his actions and what he did that showed he intended to violate the law or intended to violate the law, and all the evidence spoke to the contrary. So I think it's pretty clear that what he did was not intended to violate the law. And especially when we look at the Sanders case, the Dobbs case, and all the other cases that deal with money laundering that show that all the facts here clearly show he didn't do that. So I think the evidence is clear to that the evidence was insufficient as related to the money laundering count. I'd like to move on to the two issues as far as relates to sentencing. The main issue I'd like the court to consider on sentencing is that you have Mr. Arledge, who received a sentence of 188 months. And it's clear from the record that I did argue for a variance or a downward departure. And I asked the court to look at what Judge Schell's reasoning, or when he does depart and when he doesn't depart. He talked about that the only thing, the things he looks at to determine of when he departs or not is, are they young? Was there any violence? Were there any weapons used? And look at their criminal history. When you look at the sentence, look at Mr. Arledge, he had no criminal history, had zero criminal history points. Obviously, no weapons or violence were used. So then he only didn't meet, he's not young. And so it's our position that Judge Schell didn't adequately consider all the factors in the case, because if any case was justifiable for a variance, it was this case. And so we'd ask the court that the 188-month sentence was not reasonable when you look at all the case law and his reasoning to impose a 188-month sentence. And then finally, we do get to the counsel of choice issue. It was argued, the previous counsel argued that Mr. Lurick wanted to be Mr. Arledge's counsel. Mr. Arledge wanted him to be his lawyer. And originally, Judge Bush said there was an actual conflict. It was appealed to Judge Schell, who then said there was only a potential conflict. We believe that there was not a substantial risk of potential conflict in that situation. Co-defendants had signed conflict waivers. They were on file with the court and entered into intelligently and knowingly. And because of that, the case law is very clear. Because he was denied his counsel of choice, it results in a reversal of his conviction. Thank you, Your Honor.